from KQED.
This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. In Monday's proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, a study calling its findings conservative, concludes that over 4% of inmates sentenced to death in the United States are innocent. The study was based on a review of 7,482 death sentences handed down from 1973 to 2004. And we want to discuss the findings and what they mean in this Forum segment. Joining us is Professor Samuel Gross. He's professor of law at the University of Michigan Law School in Ann Arbor and lead author of The Rate of False Convictions Among Criminal Defendants Who Are Sentenced to Death. He's also co-founder and editor of the National Registry of Exonerations. Welcome, Samuel Gross.
Great to be here.
Good to have you here. Well, people may be wondering, how do you come to a conclusion like this? And that is obviously my lead question here.
We're able to calculate this because of two things. First, the rate of exonerations in capital cases is far higher than for any other category of crimes, high enough so that it appears that the majority in some categories of cases in which defendants are innocent are actually detected and the defendants released because of innocence. And second, because we know a lot about death sentences case by case. We have much better data on death sentences than any other category of criminal convictions in the United States. And from that, we're able to come up with an estimate of what the rate of exonerations would be if all the people who were sentenced to death had the benefit of the type of exacting and thorough process for re-examining their cases and trying to determine if they might be innocent that we apply to those who are under threat of execution. And if we had that process running for long enough to, you know, roughly, basically, sort of scrub out all the cases of innocence from the group of people who were sentenced to death. And that's how we produce the estimate of 4% who would be exonerated if we tried hard enough for long enough.
But in 2008, you published a study that said 2.3%, pretty much using the same methodology, which I guess is called survival analysis. It's a kind of study that's or method that's used in medical studies.
That is the method we use. The study in 2008 that I published with Barbara O'Brien, and which does have an estimate of 2.3%, does not use survival analysis. That study, which says that this is a underestimate, that this is a lower bound, and that the real rate is higher, only does one thing. It estimates the it doesn't estimate, it just provides the proportion of cases in which defendants who were sentenced to death were executed among those that are old enough, cases that in which the conviction was at least 15 years before the time the study ended, so that we were pretty confident that most exonerations that ever would occur had occurred. But it doesn't do another thing. It doesn't take into account the exonerations that would not be detected among those people, this group is ultimately the majority of people who are sentenced to death, who are removed from death row and resentenced to life imprisonment. What we see is that we spend a huge amount of time and a large amount of money and a great amount of care and anxiety worrying about the possibility that someone who might be executed is innocent. And that produces a very high rate of exonerations because we care about this issue more than any other issue in the area. But once someone who was sentenced to death is removed from that threat, once their sentence is changed to a sentence of life imprisonment, that all drops away. And they become just another lifer in prison, of whom we have many thousands. And the chances that they will get anybody's attention or be exonerated drop down by a factor of 8. So, and as a result, in that group, those who were once sentenced to death but are now just serving terms of life imprisonment, there are many cases of innocence that are not detected. And survival analysis allows us to focus in on the process that is most efficient, the process that we use to detect innocence among the group of people who still may be executed, and that's what provides a better and larger estimate than we were able to get in 2008.
Well, it's very revelatory to realize that there's a kind of special attention paid to those under a death sentence as opposed to those who get life imprisonment, and for, I guess one can infer from your study, you're sort of put in repose and a kind of neglect to a much greater degree. But let me just get this straight with you.
Let me interrupt for a second. Yeah. It's an interesting and ironic and very disturbing fact. There are people who have been exonerated about whom we can say with a great deal of confidence, if they had not been sentenced to death, they would be in prison now and they would probably die in prison. That the reason the problems in their case that led to serious reconsideration and ultimately proved their innocence came up is because of the attention that was paid to it, because of the threat of exoneration. A defendant by the name of John Thompson in New Orleans came within a month of execution, at which point a last-minute, desperate investigation uncovered the fact that in one of the two cases he'd been convicted of, the prosecution had concealed the fact that blood tests on a pair of pants that had the blood of the criminal on it had already before his trial showed that he was not the criminal. That had been concealed for 20 years. That came up in a last-minute, last-ditch attempt to save him from execution, and the effect was that over a period of a couple of years, the entire set of convictions that ended him in Angola prison under sentence of death unraveled, and he was released. If he had not come that close to execution, it is likely that none of that would happen, and he would probably still be in prison today.
Talking with Samuel Gross, professor of law, University of Michigan Law School, and lead author of The Rate of False Convictions Among Criminal Defendants Who Are Sentenced to Death. He's also co-founder and editor of the National Registry of Exonerations. Just to give a picture here of what kind of numbers we're talking about, Professor Gross, since 1973, when your study began, focusing on that year, 144 sentenced death defendants have been exonerated in the United States. So you're saying, essentially, in that same time period, up to 2004, at least 340 would have been unjustly put to death.
Not unjustly put to death. Most people who were sentenced to death in the United States are never executed. Some of them die on death row of disease or suicide. As time passes, many of them will die of old age. Many of them are resentenced to life imprisonment and then die in prison eventually from natural causes or possibly also suicide. So of those people who are sentenced to death in the United States, ultimately perhaps 20% will be executed. That's guesswork because we don't know going forward. But in the sample that we had here over the period that we covered, I think the rate of execution was something like 15%. Is that right? No, 13%. That's in fact a critical aspect of the system that really underlies the whole structure of the research we did. We sentence people to death, but for most of them, that turns into a life sentence.
We're talking again with Professor Samuel Gross. You may want to weigh in here. In fact, let me invite listeners to express their concerns, opinions, responses to this study that we're fleshing out here. And you may indeed ask questions as well. And if you'd like to join us, you can join us now. Our toll-free number is available. That number is 866-733-6786. We do welcome your calls and welcome your participation. So, again, feel free to join the program. Toll free at 866-733-6786 or email us forum@kqed.org or post any questions or comments right onto our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. You can also, of course, go to our Facebook page or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. And we'll go to your calls and emails and online postings and the rest in just a moment. I just want to say, though, this whole idea of 1 in 25 people sentenced to death likely to be innocent is pretty jarring from a number of perspectives, Professor Gross. I mean, I'm looking at this as neutrally as one can. You go in jurisprudence from Learned Hand all the way to Antonio Scalia, and you realize that false accusations from their perspectives, I mean, because they both spoke publicly about this, were negligible in our system as they saw it. I think Scalia said there's a success rate of, you know, over 99.9%. What does this do about all of those kinds of perceptions that have been pretty much steadfast in American jurisprudence?
Scalia's statement, I think, was silly when he made it and looks even sillier now. 99.97%, I mean, that sounds, if you go back to the Cold War, like a vote in the Supreme Soviet. I mean, that means no system is that accurate.
Or North Korea voting for Kim Jong-un.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. But what it reflects is a belief that many people had about the criminal justice system, and to be honest, that I had. I used to be a criminal defense lawyer in San Francisco, as it happens. And although people may not realize this, criminal defense lawyers, as much as prosecutors and judges, were then and may still be prone to the belief that the system is highly accurate. I, at the time that I was practicing and for years after that, and when I first started working on the subject, it never occurred to me that the rate of errors was anywhere near as high as it appears to be. The reason is, there are two reasons, I think. First, the system is generally accurate. A 4% error rate means a 96% success rate, and that's high. And second, and this is, I think, the part that really makes it hard to see what's going on, false convictions, by their nature, are things that we do not see. If we know that someone's innocent, he's never convicted in the first place. The cases that we know about are those very few false convictions that come to light years later because a lot of effort has been invested in them, and you've gotten the attention of courts or prosecutors or governors who are willing to say, the jury got it wrong, we should correct that. But usually when someone's convicted in error, we can't tell them apart from the people who were guilty, and nothing is ever done about it. Death sentences are different. As we were saying before, we spend so much more time on them and put so many more resources into reinvestigating them and are so concerned about the danger of executing innocent people that we actually discover a substantial proportion of all the errors that are made. And that's what makes it possible to learn about the process as we have done here. But I understand the background of the statements that Learned Hand and Antonin Scalia made, because if you work in the system, you very rarely see these cases. They come up years later and almost only in unusual cases where a huge amount of attention has been paid to them.
Let me bring our callers on, and we go first to Leslie. Good morning.
Good morning.
You're on the air.
Hi. I don't know if I missed something, but my question is there statistics available, are there statistics available regarding wrongful conviction for prisoners who are not on death row? So a percentage that might be false convictions or, you know, for those that have not been convicted to death or life sentence even.
No, there are not. This is the first reliable estimate of the rate of false convictions, of erroneous convictions in any context. And the reason that it's possible to do it here is what I mentioned before, that we know so much more both about the process of sentencing people to death and about the number of those who are innocent because we spend so much more time reinvestigating the cases after conviction.
But forgive me, we've always operated under the assumption that the rate of erroneous convictions of criminal defendants it's often characterized as unknown or unknowable.
That's correct, and that's exactly right. We've said we will never know or we can't know, and in general we don't know. This 4.1% estimate does not apply to other categories of murder, let alone other crimes. It could be higher or it could be lower. Very likely it's quite different from one type of crime to another. But this suggests that it's not negligible. If it's 4.1% for capital murders, you'd think that it would be, you know, maybe 1, maybe 3, maybe 7% for other murders or for robberies and rapes. But we don't actually have that information. We do, in the National Registry of Exonerations, is the best source, have information on those cases in which people have been exonerated, in which they have been freed and released because of new evidence of innocence. As of today, we know of 1,362 of those exonerations since 1989. But we are deeply aware of the fact that that is a very small proportion of all of the wrongful convictions that are unknown.
More of your calls. Let me go to San Jose next. Kevin, you're on. Good morning.
Good morning. What is hardly ever discussed in this matter, and the real heart of the problem, is that there are, on the district attorney side, there are prosecutors who believe that everybody is guilty, and there is no remorse or hardly ever any prosecutions on the crime of malicious prosecution. These people are given a pass, you know, on the prosecution side, and that's it's hardly ever brought up, except a few pieces on 60 Minutes, and I think that is the real heart of the problem. Thank you.
All right, thank you for that statement, Professor Gross. Want to respond?
Prosecutorial misconduct is a serious problem. I mentioned earlier the case of John Thompson in New Orleans, which is an outrageous case of prosecutorial misconduct, and there are quite a few others among the death row exonerations that we know about, and among other exonerations generally. It is a serious problem, and the caller is quite right. When it's detected, very little is done either to punish the people who are guilty of it, in a court of law, or to discipline them in the profession, to disbar them or suspend them from the practice of law. He's exactly right. I want to say, on the other hand, though, this is a minority of prosecutors. This is not the rule. When it happens, it is outrageous, and it should be treated very seriously. But the caller, I believe, is from San Jose. The Santa Clara County District Attorney's Office several years ago created a conviction integrity unit and has been taking the issue very seriously, affirmatively going out and looking for cases of possible innocence that should be corrected, and trying to institute procedures that will avoid false convictions in the future. That's part of a movement that is perhaps catching on around the country, prosecutors beginning to address this problem very seriously and take it on as one of their responsibilities. And I hope that becomes more general.
Well, here's a listener who seems to agree with the last caller. Sean writes, holding corrupt or incompetent police and district attorneys accountable would eliminate the vast majority of wrongful convictions. Start there. Another listener writes, please differentiate between innocent and wrongfully convicted. Some prisoners are guilty of a crime, yet with botched investigations or trials. Some are guilty of other crimes, example, the driver, not the shooter. Few of those innocents are completely guilt-free, honest citizens. And this may be beyond your purview, Professor Gross, but Michael from Oakland writes, if the streamlined process proposed as a ballot initiative by former governors Wilson, Davis, and Schwarzenegger were implemented, what effect might that have on the rate of wrongful convictions and executions in California? That was an initiative that would streamline the whole slow appeals process.
Well, there are two questions I might comment on there. Let me get to the initiative second. The one before that is, what do we mean by innocence and exoneration? What we mean by exoneration is that the person was completely cleared of any culpability for the conduct for which he or she was sentenced to death. So someone who was sentenced to death and then got a new trial, and in the second trial it was determined to have a lesser role in the case, or got a new trial and instead of going to trial pled guilty to second-degree murder, or in some other way had their level of conviction or level of culpability reduced, does not count as someone who's been exonerated. Exoneration in this context means that the entire conviction, every part of it at every level, has been removed and erased.
It means no culpability at all.
No culpability. Now, does that mean the person is innocent? Well, the truth is that innocence or guilt are things that human beings determine. And in this case, the legal system determines that somebody who was convicted is no longer considered guilty, and on the basis of new evidence of innocence. And in most of these cases, there's no doubt at the end that the person is innocent, but that's the best we can do. What we do in this study and in the work in the National Registry of Exonerations is we do not try to use our own judgment to make our own decisions about whether somebody who was once convicted of a crime is in fact guilty or innocent. That would be a fool's game. Why would we know better than anybody else? We rely on official determinations by courts and prosecutors and governors, and that's the best we can do. And I think it's a good way to study the issue. On the effect of the initiative that's been proposed in California to speed up the process, if it does have the effect of speeding up the process of execution, that will mean that more innocent people are executed. The process of producing exonerations, of identifying innocent people, is a slow one. The average time to exoneration from conviction in death cases is about 10 years. But some of the cases take 15, some take 20. A person who was recently released from death row in Louisiana had been there for 30 years. The shorter the process is, the more we say, let's make it quicker, more efficient, the more likely we are to execute innocent people.
You're listening to Forum, and if you've just joined us, we're talking to Professor Samuel Gross, who is professor of law at University of Michigan Law School and lead author of The Rate of False Convictions Among Criminal Defendants Who Are Sentenced to Death. He's also co-founder and editor of the National Registry of Exonerations, and I believe we're going to try to put the report and the study you've done online here, if we can, on our website. And also want to remind you that you are listening to Forum, and this is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support this radio station, KQED, go to kqed.org. And I'm Michael Krasny. And let's go to more of your calls. Let me go to Chansey. Good morning. Hi, Chansey. You're on.
Hi, good morning. Yeah, I'm wondering if the 4% is fairly consistent over the 30 years of the study, or if you observe any changes in technologies or policies that impacted that rate. And I'll take the call off, answer off the air.
We don't have enough information to see if there was any change over time. The number of exonerations that we're dealing with is 117, which is a very large number in this context, but it's too small to detect changes in time over a period of 25 years. But there's an underlying issue that I could say something about. People ask about whether changes in technology will make the process of determining guilt or innocence more accurate. And usually what they are thinking about and sometimes ask about explicitly is DNA technology, the capacity to identify people from their DNA. The answer is that's not likely to have much of an effect in death penalty cases, which are, of course, all murder cases. DNA technology has been revolutionary in treating rape cases where the identity of the rapist is an issue. And there I suspect, although we don't know, but I suspect that the rate of errors has gone down greatly since the 1990s. But very few murder cases have that sort of biological evidence. Some of them involve rapes and do have biological evidence that can be tested for DNA. A small number of murders that don't involve rape have biological evidence that can identify the perpetrator. As a result of all of the death row exonerations that we know about, only 18, about 13% of them, involve any DNA evidence. So DNA technology will have made the process somewhat more accurate, but it won't be a big effect on capital cases.
And we bring in another caller. Anna, good morning. Welcome to Forum. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I appreciate there's all this talk about this is my question. So there isn't a lot of talk about jurors. There isn't a lot of education. People usually say, how do I get out of jury service? When a lot of these decisions are sitting in the laps of 12 people plus two alternates. How come we're not talking about that? How come we're not talking about empowering those individuals and educating them and teaching them their rights as jurors? Because so much of the time people say, I wasn't really sure, so I said guilty. I've had this experience. I live in Martinez. I talk to a lot of jurors. It's really upsetting. And I was wondering if there's some place for jurors to educate themselves within the legal means they're allowed. But what is going on here?
Juror education. Some thoughts from you, Professor Gross?
Well, jury trials are a central piece of our criminal justice system. And unlike other punishments, in death penalty cases, in most states, it's juries rather than judges who determine the punishment. So the caller is quite right that the role of juries is absolutely central. And there certainly are cases in which juries misunderstand their role, do not evaluate the evidence independently. That said, I'm a fan of the jury system. I think juries are good at determining facts. I think they're good at evaluating evidence if they're fairly chosen and have the evidence that should be presented to them before them. They're not perfect, and many jurors don't understand their function. That is a problem. How to improve the jury system? I wish I knew.
Here's Sarah, who writes, "Our legal system needs to be more consistent. Too many people get a variety of sentences for the same horrible offenses. Each state should not be allowed to pick different options. Having our country's punishment be all the same will send a more direct message. The error rates, the error rates of people being innocent is sad, and there definitely needs to be a streamlined, consistent process on how everything is done, from police departments, interviews, collecting evidence, to the courtroom. Too many exceptions are making these problems." What about that idea, Samuel Gross, of standardizing things or making them simply more consistent?
Well, it is the opposite of what happens in the United States. The American criminal justice system is beyond fragmented. It's atomized. The caller, or the writer, I should say, mentions that we should be more consistent across states. But states aren't even the main unit in which these decisions are made. There are 50 states in the United States, but there are also something like 3,100 counties, and most of the decisions about prosecution are made by county-level prosecutors. As for police departments, there's something like 18,000 police departments in the United States, and they're each run independently of each other. So procedures and standards and training are all over the place. I would be in favor of more standardization, but I should say that the suggestion of having national standards runs against a strong belief in local control over criminal procedure in the United States. This is seen as a state issue and, to a great extent, a local issue.
Well, we'll leave it there, and we thank Professor Gross for being with us. Samuel Gross, again, is professor of law at University of Michigan Law School and the lead author of a report called The Rate of False Convictions Among Criminal Defendants Who Are Sentenced to Death. You can read that on our website, and it's in the Monday's issue of the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science. Thank you, Samuel Gross.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you, our listeners. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Larberg. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Mark. Senior editor is Dan Zoll, and our interns are Jack Detch, Marisa Endicott, Mariam Jamil, Hannah Rose Levy, Audrey Gertz, and Daniel Radin. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegas Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.